8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Okay, if I could have your attention, I'd appreciate it. Thank you. You're in an exam now. So take all of your books and everything that you own and put it down underneath your chairs. How you doing, Matt? Did you learn anything?
Yeah.
Learned a lot, huh?
Yeah.
Can I have your attention? You guys, seriously. Matt, please. I know you're excited and nervous and tired, and hopefully you learned some things that maybe you should have learned a few weeks ago. Don't worry about that because you won't need that book. So just hold it, Jordan, will you? Just keep it till the end of class. It's not that important. So you guys can take your seats. We'll go over a few things. Did you learn anything? Tired?
A little.
Me too. Gloria, question? Mike, you have a question? Sure? Okay. Now, this is supposed to be a fun experience. Betty, you're not going to a funeral here. That's what I want to see. Great. A couple announcements. Those of you who are in this exciting lab, which it will be for next quarter, and there you are, all 10 of you, there will be an introductory meeting after your discussion next Wednesday. And so it'll be at 6 p.m., and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later on. And it's going to be a very fascinating experience. Next week, I'm going to talk on Tuesday about genetics and the law, so I'm going to continue on this legal theme. And then I'm going to switch back to a little bit of science on Thursday, and I'm going to talk about the human genome, but really I'm going to talk about this concept of races and what we've learned about genetic engineering and molecular biology as it applies to human genetic diversity. And so these should be a lot of fun. Discussion next week is also going to be a lot of fun because it's going to be a discussion on how genetic engineering is used for bioweapons. And so you'll be reading three Scientific American articles, one on anthrax and how what anthrax does and how it is a lethal killer if it's not combated. You'll be reading a fascinating Scientific American article on how they use genetic engineering to figure out what the exact flu was that was responsible for the pandemic of 1918 that killed over 30 million people. And that was just done a few years ago. It's a fascinating story. And then you'll read a little bit about biotechnology and how it can be used to combat biopathogens. The assignments, we have graded your double helix assignment. You'll get it back. It's been graded for about a week. But we've been holding on to it. You'll have it back on Tuesday. You'll have your quiz 5 back on Tuesday. You'll have your take-home exam that you handed in today back on Tuesday. No ifs, ands, or buts. And then your quiz number 6 will be back on Wednesday. And then next Thursday, you'll have a group of questions that you will answer on your final oral exam. And those will be handed out to you a week from today so that you have a week to prepare those. And I'll say a little bit more about that next week. Okay, there's a class dinner on Tuesday, just like we had last Tuesday, this week, which was a lot of fun. And Charles, Nico, David, Patricia, Victoria, and Jessica, you're all part of the show, so please RSVP to Jessica. And now we are here for the show of the day. The first thing is that this is really supposed to be a positive experience. And so keep in mind that this is nothing that you should be, have Parkinson's disease over. I want you to relax. And if you've done your work And if you've signed the exam, you should be confident that you understand this material. And you should be aware by now that what we're doing now is really supposedly a positive catalyst as a learning experience. So the way this is going to work is that Mike and Gloria and I have divided you into 8 groups. And these are groups that have been mostly randomly put together, okay, with a little bit of fudging here and there, but mostly randomly. So you'll be in groups with people that you haven't worked before, presumably, or maybe some people you have. You're going to come up and pick a question, 1 through 5, and bonus 1, and bonus 2, and bonus 3, and that's the question for your group. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take a break for 15 minutes. And you guys get together in your group and formulate the answer to your question collectively. And so that you can have a collective group answer. And then we gather back in and you have exactly 10 minutes to answer your question. And every single person in the group must participate. So if you have 5 people, you have to hand the microphone from one person to the other as you go down and answer the question. So that would mean if there's 5 parts to a question, there's 5 people in the group, person 1 does part 1, person 2 does part 2, person 3 does part 3, 4, and 5. No notes, nothing written, no boning up on anything, and the most important thing in all of this is to recognize that the first group that goes up and answers a question, that's great because they're done, but then the last group has to sit there for the whole couple of hours. And so what that means is that there's no, it's again an honor system. It's hard to enforce, but it's an honor system. There's no presumably thinking and studying and caucusing because it's not fair. And in general, this has worked really well, wouldn't you say, Tomo? I mean, it really has. So you have to be, in a sense, you're really doing something for your classmates, not for me. And so it's important. When you have the final oral exam, you'll see. But I'm smiling, but I won't tell you why. In any case, you'll find out next week. But, no questions. But let me say that there will be many surprises along the way in this exam. So if you think you're done with your group, you might not be done with your group because I'm the final arbiter. And someone might be answering part 5 of question 1, but I don't really want to hear them answer part 5 of question 1. I may randomly call on someone in another group. So the idea here is to be on your toes and to be thinking and to be aware, and also to learn. That's the bottom line, because that's the deal. Now, Daisy, I'll allow you 1 question, and then we got to break and get this thing going. No. You do it all orally, collectively, together. Okay? No notes, no anything. Yeah.
Do we get to look at the question?
No. Yes, of course. You have the exam right in front of you. Okay, can you give out the groups, and would you organize into groups, please, as quietly and as efficiently as possible? Just give it to some other people. Brandon, Tomo, hand some of these things out. As quickly as possible, Gloria and Mike. Okay, as soon as you get your, so you see your little groups, those are the people that you're working with. Okay, hold on, Yuditha, please. I know it's a little bit different from what you're used to, but some of you may be jumping up and down and some of you might, I don't know. Okay. Now we have this little bag down here. Mike, can you do the honors, please? I want 1 person from group number 1 to come up here and grab.
All right, where's group 1?
Come on, just 1 person. They don't have a representative yet. Just 1 person. Just come up and grab the question. This is group number 1, and write down your question. What's your question, Group 1? Okay. Group 1 has question number 5. Can I have Group 2 come up here, please? Shauna? Okay, hold on. Seriously, all of you. Group 2 has question number 1. Group 3's representative, where are you? Come on down to the front. Daisy, come on down to the front, Daisy. So question number 5 is group 1. Question number 1 is okay, hold on. Is it question 1 or bonus 1? Okay. Group number 2 has bonus number 1. Okay. Okay. And your group? Group 3 has question number 3. Great. Wonder what the probability of that is. We have group number 4. What question? Matt? Group 2 had bonus 1. Who has question 5?
Group 1. Yeah, okay. Yeah. You got it.
Group 1.
Yeah, you got it.
Who has question number 3? Okay. Number 4. Got it. So group 4 has question 1. Thank you. Next group, 5. What are we doing here, Mike?
He thought he was in group 5, but he wasn't in group 5.
Group 5 has what?
Number 4.
Okay, group 5 has number 4.
Yep.
Go to the next one, please.
Who is group 6?
Let's go, Sam. Okay, everybody, no talking.
Group 6
has question 2. Let's go to the next group, which would be group 7. Bonus number 3 for group number 7. And then group number 8 has bonus number 2. So let's go over this again. Group 1, what is your question? 5. Group number 2, what is your question? Group number 3, what is your question? Group number 4, what is your question? Group number 5, what is your question? Group number 6, what is your question? 7, group 7, and group 8. Okay, now, you have it's a quarter to 4, so you now have exactly 15 minutes to organize your answers collectively. You can go anywhere you want, outside, go in the courtyard, wherever you want to go. Sometimes it's best just to go to different places, go in the hallway, go on the patio. Okay, so many of you guys just want to go outside. Take your groups just outside. Gloria, get them outside. One of those groups outside.
Tell them to go outside?
Yeah. It's too many people.
All of them?
No, just a couple of groups. So take one of your groups outside. Okay.
We'll find out by tomorrow when we're like going through
on, Mike. Okay, can you all sit with your groups, please? Where's my stuff? Oh, there it is. Good. You all take your seats with your groups. Where's the Reds? Ay-sh. Okay, where's group number one? Where's group number two? Yuditha? Hannah, thank you. Jessica, Melissa. Brian. Guys, ready? Ready? What am I doing here? Gloria, what are you doing? You're sitting over here? Yeah. Where's Mike? Sitting over here? Got it? Everyone set? See anyone smiling? See a couple of you. What's the matter, Kyle? Pardon? Nothing's the matter. Let's do bonus number three, group number seven. You know, maybe I'll take that hand mic, Jack. And I'll let them use the, yeah. They need the microphones. You must talk to those microphones. Okay. Now, let me sit down. And I'll stand up. Here's the deal. You get graded individually and as a group. Okay? And that's what Mike and Gloria are writing down right now. And you get graded 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1 is high and 5 is low. And then we'll translate that into some points at some point thereafter. And so I want you to just be on your toes and think and look at this as a positive learning experience, because I know if you learn a lot. And let's go from there. And if I go over time, someone will tell me, I'm sure. Let me get my old running watch out here. Okay, so we have bonus number three, group number seven. And this question, as you all have in front of you, deals with fingerprinting your HC70A class. So you have 10 minutes to answer that question.
Can we use the board?
Have to use the board. You can use either board.
Okay. Well, the first question is, how many different D1S80 alleles are there in the HC70 class?
So what's the concept of the question?
Well, trying to find the different alleles in the class population.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the reasons for the different alleles.
Okay.
So I'm question A, and
Talk to the class. You're not talking to me.
Okay. Well, you basically have to look at this to figure out how many alleles there are. And from what I understand, is you have these DNA fingerprints like this, and you have the ladders on the side, and they don't exactly line up. And the first ladder is 370, and the one over here is 370. So what you have to do is draw like a line like that, because it shows that the gel consistency here is different from here, and it gradually goes up like that. So when you draw those lines out like that, you're going to see that the alleles fall into a certain pattern. And basically, from what I understood, there were five alleles, A1 through A5. And A1 is the largest, which is basically up here. And A5 is the smallest, A1 is the largest. And yeah, that's it. There were a few differences, but in like maybe caused by band shifting, but that's basically the pattern that I saw.
Part B.
Yo, I'm doing part B. As you can all see on the back of the little quiz handout that we have, or the midterm handout, if we split it up according to there being five alleles, then, I could draw it. Is it all right?
Go
that
ahead.
You guys, well, I don't think I need to draw because everybody can just look on their sheet. Okay. But so basically, if you're going down from the top, as we're ordering them from largest to smallest, as far as how many variable number tandem repeats are in a row, I have only one line, and it's at the A2, the second allele spot. So that means that coincidentally, both my parents must have had the same gene that they each passed to me. And that basically answers this question. So when we're looking at it, we're seeing, since each of your parents are passing one gene to you, and if you only have one line, then as I do, then that means they both pass the exact same gene. And so out of the five genes, they could have,
so they both passed. So homozygous or heterozygous?
So I am homozygous.
Okay. Let's go to part C.
Homo.
Okay, Anton. It's not on.
There we go. I am homozygous for the allele A3. You can see that right here.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we'll calculate the frequency of this genotype in the population of our class is to divide the number of people who have this genotype that I have, which I counted to be 9, by the total number of people. So the genotype frequency is going to be 9 divided by 44.
Okay. Next part.
Okay, for part D, it asked to explain the possible mechanism for the genetic diversity in the HC78 class. And what that mechanism would be is any kind of mutation, either a single nucleotide mutation, an inversion, translocation on the chromosome, specifically that would change a restriction site. Let's say that this is the DNA for the gene, and this is the area the probe would bind to. Depending on changes to restriction sites on the gene.
Are you positive about that group? Better caucus on that one.
Or?
The question asks, how can you generate allelic diversity using VNTRs?
Or the number of repeats.
Well, you better caucus with your group here and how that can happen. Question asked for what's the mechanism for generating allelic differences, allelic diversity in the number of repeats? Doesn't say anything about restriction sites. Okay, what's the answer?
The mechanism would be more or less repeats in the...
Yeah, but how does that happen?
It would occur because of a addition to the sequence.
I think you better help each other here. I want to get bogged down on this.
Could it be crossing over?
Don't ask me.
Okay, we think...
Provide a mechanism. Show it to me, diagram it out.
All right, Anton. We have the two...
You have 3 minutes to do it at most.
The two chromosomes with the homologous regions that cross over during...
You mean the chromatids cross over? Okay, go ahead.
No, areas can cross over. And maybe there's a DNTR sequence from here that gets...
How can that generate different numbers of repeats? Final chance to answer that question. You're close, but you're not on the money.
Okay. Basically, what happens is that when the crossing over happens, the parents' chromosomes aren't directly, or the parents' genes aren't directly transferred into the embryo or the new cell. Basically, crossing over basically means that instead of having
just draw it
the exact same.
You're all correct, and I don't want to get bogged down in this. You're all correct that crossing over is involved, but I want to know how it generates different numbers of repeats. That's the question.
So if this is what it looks like originally in the parent...
Well, why don't you draw it out with repeat 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5,
okay,
and show me how you can generate... Well, why don't you just use two lines straight across, forget these chromosomes because they're meaningless, and show me how that can happen.
So...
Okay.
What happens is, if this is, let's say, the father and this is the mother right here, when crossing over occurs, you can basically have a random arrangement.
Go ahead.
You have a random arrangement of the father's and mother's chromosomes and VNTRs in the offspring. So, for example, instead of having the whole of the father's and the whole of the mother's combine, you might have, like, the father's, you know, gets, like, this part put over here and this part put over here.
No, I don't think so. Let's go to the next part.
Well, in the next part, the question has to do with the uniformity, allelic or genetic uniformity, in our class subpopulations. And we felt that there isn't enough information on our classmates to determine if there are any subpopulations. So we answered that there is no evidence for uniformity.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone have any questions of this group? Does anyone have any questions? Samantha, do you have any questions of this group? Kyle, do you have any questions of this group? Heather? You're satisfied with their answers and they got them all conceptually? You understood the answer to this bonus question from what they described?
Not the crossing over part, but I didn't answer that question in regard to VNTRs.
We need microphones here, guys. Okay, so let's have Brian, you explain how you get different numbers of alleles.
Like in VNTRs or just different
VNTRs.
Numbers? Okay. In VNTRs, during crossing over, what can happen is that not... can I go up on the board? Is
it sure, absolutely. Easier? Yeah, or anyone. Go ahead. So crossing over is where the homologous chromosomes pair and they exchange information. So the DNA breaks and rejoins. So the mother chromosome breaks and the father chromosome breaks. And then they rejoin in a random way, only between the chromosomes that come from the mother and the father, like... So what's the concept here, Brian? Quickly.
If there's a different number of repeats, then what can happen is that when they cross over, like it can be a different combination.
How? Still missing the main concept here. You're close, but you have these aligned in a kind of weird way. Why is that?
Different length of the chromosome? Because
no, because these are homologous chromosomes. So this would be a chromosome number one. And this would be a chromosome number one prime, okay? And now they're going to line up exactly the same, okay? Now, how can you generate from having five repeats in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so we have seven repeats here, five repeats there. That's two different alleles. How do we start generating new alleles from this that might have one repeat, 6 repeats, 12 repeats? How do you do that? That's the question. Go ahead.
I think it's called chromosome shuffling.
Nope.
Okay, well, can I try to explain it? Maybe like this one comes here when they're crossing over?
Nope. Okay. One more should have stabbed. Go ahead, Summer. Then we'll move. This was in one of the handouts.
Wouldn't it just be if equal portions of, let's say, the bottom of both of the homologous chromosomes crossed over, then you'd have two from the seven side that
move over?
But
how do you do that when two things are lined up absolutely perfectly?
They should switch perfectly too, right?
Yeah, so that means if they switch perfectly, you wind up with so many on this side and so many on that side, but you haven't generated anything new.
Well, I mean, if three from the seven side switch over to five from that side, then you have eight. All of a sudden.
Only if what happens? Only if one thing happens. Does anyone know? It's okay. Only if the chromosomes don't align perfectly with each other, so you get an unequal crossing over, so that you get an unequal distribution of genetic information in each of those different chromosomes. It's called unequal crossing over. And it was in one of the handouts, but we don't have to belabor that. Now, I have one more question, then we're going to have to move on. How do you precisely get the size of the alleles? You said draw these lines, you know, but I'm confused at how one can get the number of different alleles just from, you can sit down, Brian, just from a ladder, and then there's all these different things, and you're just drawing lines across and matching them up. How can you get to all those different alleles just from doing something like that? What would be a more scientific way of doing this? Well, all of you collectively, it's a collective answer. Okay, what's the answer? So how do you do it? Conceptually now. Hurry up, Corinne. I'm going to give you 1 minute and that's it.
Okay, I tried to calculate how many alleles there were based on how they lined up relative to each other.
How can you do it scientifically without just looking, that you can actually do it formally?
Are you talking about band shifting?
Calculating? How do you think you could actually do this scientifically? Each gel has markers, right? Three different gels because it couldn't run it on one gel. They all have markers. And how do you think you could do this formally, without eyeballing it, and actually get data on this and would calculate it as precisely as you could imagine, down to 20 nucleotides? How do you think you could do that? Jordan. You're going to have a microphone. And then we'll end it.
I believe you could figure out the length of the fragments that are actually traveling down this.
How do you do that?
Well, depending on the length of a fragment, smaller fragments travel further, and if you knew, like, the density of the gel.
So what's the purpose of the ladder?
The ladder lets you, like, you have these known fragment lengths, so that depending on, like, how far they travel, you can be like, okay, if something is 20 kilobases long, it'll travel this far. If it's 30 kilobases long, it'll travel this far.
There it is. You get a graph.
Yeah. get
so
a graph.
So the relationship between size and distance down the gel, and that's what the markers are for. So all you had to do was measure those with a ruler, and then measure a ruler across and put all the different points on your graph, which won't be exactly linear, and then you can determine the size from that y-axis, and that's how you would do it scientifically. Let's go to the next question. Good job. Okay, let's go to question number bonus 2, group 8. So this deals with DNA testing in the law. And this question deals with a bill that's before the California Senate. So you have 10 minutes.
Okay, the bill is for testing for genetic defects that will allow infants to live a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the group said that they were for this bill. But me personally, I was against it for several reasons.
Well, give a group answer, not a personal answer.
Okay, the group's for the bill.
It's a group answer. Got to reach consensus on these answers.
I'll go first and come back. Okay, so our group voted that we were for the bill, and there we're each going to give you a couple reasons why. For starters, we believe that the bill should be passed because it decreases medical costs for the state by preventing, by detecting a disease early and possibly being able to prevent it. Like, for example, PKU, in which the diet of an infant would just be restricted in a certain way. You greatly decrease medical costs for treating a disease that you could have prevented. And by giving people that information, you're allowing them to do that.
Okay. That's
the reason. The reason that I think that the bill should be passed, and we thought as a group, is that the Constitution of the United States is an extremely brilliant document. And in the preamble of the Constitution, there are 8 very, very important syllables, which promote the general welfare. And that's a very broad idea. Sorry. That's a very broad idea.
Smash Lisa here in the face.
But,
go ahead.
But under this concept...
Promoting the general welfare.
Promote the general welfare... This test that would require parents to get their children tested would undoubtedly increase the general welfare because more people would be born as healthy individuals, or they would have the option of treating a disease which could be preventable, and just that little knowledge allows someone possibly to treat the disease and live a healthy, happy, normal life, as the question stipulates.
Next part of your answer. Group answer.
My reasoning is that...
group reasoning.
Or, yeah. The group reasoning is that there is sort of a general moral responsibility for the government and just people in general to have their children get this test, because then they would be living a more happy and healthy life. So, and that's morally desirable, if that can be had.
And also along with that, it could prevent negligence by parents. What we tried to do was address the arguments against the bill in our reasoning for it so that we could convince skeptics of it. And one of the things that our anti-bill person suggested to us so wisely
was... He'll have
was,
his chance. We won't let him go on smoking.
Was ahead. That it goes against your Fourth Amendment for unreasonable search and seizure. So... our group argument against that would be that there are exceptions to the search, unreasonable search and seizure law, or I guess amendment. And I think this would be, or we think this would be a great one, because if a parent was negligent, for example, was
Keep
abusing
brief.
Their child,
Keep brief, Heather.
If a parent was abusing their child at their home, federal or state groups could come in and remove the child. Search and seize, you know, reasonably. And so we believe that it's the same sort of thing where if a parent is refusing to get their child tested just because, A, you know, they don't want to pay for it or something like that, when they could be endangering their child's life, we believe that it makes it reasonable to search and seize and take DNA.
Now, what about the minority view in this group?
Well, I believe that since we have a
be brief, Jason.
We have a precedent on phenylketonuria testing that you can actually reject it on a religious basis by saying that parents cannot refuse to have this test. It's going against the First Amendment, which is the freedom of religion. So because you can't say that I don't want this test based on religious basis. And also it's going against the precedent of former law that's already been created.
Of what?
Of the former law that's been created on phenylketonuria.
Oh, no, you have to...
Okay. Of the phenylketonuria testing on infants.
Okay. Does anyone have anything to add to that? Go ahead, Yuditha. You have 1 minute. You have actually 30 seconds.
We were saying that we don't... The group argument against precedent is that in common law, there have been multiple precedents set that have been later overturned. For example, slavery was a precedent. Or there are all kinds of precedents that exist in law that have been overturned because times have changed and people believe that law should change also. And we believe that this is a precedent that could be overturned. So precedent is not a reason to say that this law should not be passed.
Yeah. There's no Robert Bork's on the panel.
Really fast, another thing, because everything that they're going to be testing for is treatable, it's not where you're in one of these situations where, oh, you don't want to know, or you've got the twin situation, or you've got the loved one situation, so that's just kind of the other element to it, because a lot of people don't want to know if there aren't treatments, and you don't have to take that into account with this.
My question to the group is, how do you justify violating the First Amendment?
In what respect?
Pass the microphone back.
Freedom of speech, freedom of religion.
As far as freedom of speech goes, I don't see how it would be violating that right. Freedom of religion...
20 seconds, Heather.
Freedom of religion is a thing that's very subjective. And so while someone is allowed to have whatever religious beliefs they want, in the case of genetic testing, we believe as a group that it would be the risks of not testing the child would far outweigh the benefits of the child's adhering to their religion.
Any contrary or more views in 20 seconds or less in the class, and then we'll move on. Sam?
Just false positives, the potential for false positives and social stigmatization that would result from these tests. I think that's an argument against it.
Well, there was the confidentiality.
Microphone, Heather. Stigma.
The bill did include confidentiality requirements, so it would only be results would only be released to the parents and the child.
Can I just add something really quickly about the religion and speech argument? While those rights are nearly absolute, they're not absolute. Like Justice Jackson said that you can't yell fire in a crowded room. And if your religion tells you to go out and kill a little child, you can't practice that freedom of religion, obviously.
Great job. Thank you. Let's move on to the next. Okay, let's go to let me see what we want to do next. Okay, hold it. Okay. Let's go to group number two, bonus number one. So this question deals with restriction mapping, something that we don't do anymore in the genomics era, but which is very, very, very important. And what I'd like to hear from this group, because it's a challenging question to answer. Melissa, is there an issue? Chris? It's a challenging question to answer as a group. This is a challenge. And what I'd really like is a conceptual some conceptual insight into how you make restriction maps conceptually. That's the most important thing that would apply to any situation no matter what. And then secondly, how you derive just one or two positions of sites on this map, and that's about it. Okay? So we don't want to spend, you know, a whole 15 minutes playing Sudoku or something like that. Okay? But it's not the process of elimination. So let's hear the major concept here. So if you're not sure, you better talk again, because there's a concept here that we're dealing with. And it is a concept. And it can be said in one sentence. Okay, what's the answer? Let's go. What's the logic? How do you make, teach the class how to construct the restriction map?
Yeah, okay. We're going to start off by looking at the results, which are my gel electrophoresis. And we have deoxyribonucleic acids here. And they're cut by restriction enzymes by the S, for example, the S2, if you look on 17 on your test, S2 will cut one site, and produce a fragment of 36,000 base pairs and 4,000 base pairs.
Shona, how do I know that S2 only digests that fragment in one place?
You can look at either the map on page 16 of the length of the fragments, or you can look at the map on the other side.
No, but how do I know it only digests in one place? How do I know S2 enzyme has one site on that fragment?
Only one. There's two pieces, so there's one cut.
Exactly. If you look, there are two fragments, and that would mean that the restriction enzyme only cut it at one site.
Okay. We can hear from... Okay, go ahead.
The major task is trying to reconcile where the different restriction enzymes cut. And so basically, there were a variety of ways to do this, and other people will discuss that. But basically, you're just trying to reconcile the combination of them. So and how, because certain combinations will not work.
So let's just say that S2 digests one time. What about AC3? How many times does that digest? How many sites on that fragment for AC3?
Two.
And what's the evidence for that?
The three fragments.
Three fragments. So if you have three fragments, you get how many sites?
Two.
And can you show me why that is on the board, Loda?
Okay.
Just conceptually.
Okay. Since the gene that we're cutting is linear, if you cut it once, it will create two fragments. And so if you cut it another time, there are three fragments.
And show me conceptually how if you get two fragments, you have one site.
Well, then two fragments with one site, then that would be... This is the one site, so these are the two fragments.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So I still haven't heard the concept here. I've heard sort of randomly put together combinations. I haven't heard the concept. How was the experiment carried out? What was the purpose of the way in which that experiment was carried out? And from the results, how would one conceptually come up with a map?
Well, we started with using the three restriction enzymes that only cut in one place.
Great. And what was the conceptual reason for doing that?
Because then we could map the possible locations, like say...
Of possible locations
of the cut sites.
For each of those...
For each of those three.
Okay, good.
So you could say, like, for example, S2 cuts into a 4 KB fragment. And a 36 KB fragment.
Great.
So on this map, you could label like S2A at the 4 site and S2B at the 36 site.
But could it go on either side, or do you know which side it's on?
At this point, you don't know which side it's on yet.
Good.
So you do that. Okay.
Let's go to the next person in your group.
The second step in our methodology was after you find the two possible restriction sites for each of the three enzymes that have only one restriction site, you need to find combinations of those three.
And why do you use those combinations?
What do you mean?
What is the reason for using the combinations of restriction enzymes together?
Because when they made this map, they put restriction enzymes in combination.
Why? What's the reason for putting them in combination?
So that there would be some overlap. And
what do you mean by overlap?
So that some...
So show me an example on the board. So let's just assume this is the site. Let's just assume that this is the site. We won't spend a lot of time on this, but let's just assume that's site number one for restriction enzyme number one. Now you come along and you use restriction enzyme number two. What's the purpose for doing 1+2 combination of restriction enzymes? What's the concept?
Well, let's pretend that this is S2 right here, just for the sake of making an argument. If you put XBI here, there would be two possible restriction enzyme sites that it could be, and you wouldn't know where it was placed until you could put it in a combination with another restriction enzyme, analyze the fragments that you have on the list.
Well, what are the predictions then?
Well, if you draw out the map, I won't do that right here, but we're going to predict the S2, the first site that cuts.
Let me just help you a bit.
I don't know exactly what you're asking.
You'll see, that's the point.
Okay.
You have a big fragment and a little fragment from S2. What's the purpose of adding the second enzyme in combination with the first, conceptually?
Do you want to go or do you want me to finish?
You're close, but I want to know a concept.
Like so when you add the second...
Talk to the class.
When you add the restriction enzyme, what happened, a second restriction enzyme to the S2, what will happen is that there will become three fragments. So basically what you can do with the numbers... And
I have to say it conceptually, Brian. You're still talking like it's a random process. So you have two fragments from this single digestion. This is what the group has said. Map the single sites. What is the concept for using the second enzyme in combination from the first? What will you predict? What are the possibilities when you add the second enzyme to this first enzyme?
So... you have two restriction enzymes, which each one of them makes one cut. When you combine them together, you could predict that they'll make two cuts. And by analyzing the lengths of the fragments of this, what you get when you analyze them both combined, you'll be able to predict which one, you'll be able to compare to the single restriction enzyme fragments, and you'll be able to see which of the fragment lengths remain. And from that, you'll be able to use that as to sort of predict where your cuts on your map will be.
Okay. Everyone is correct, and it's terrific what you're saying. But I want to hear it conceptually, as if you're teaching the concept. Everything you said is perfect. I mean, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Learned how to restriction map. But now I want to hear it conceptually. Can you do that? Get together. So what I'm asking is, you have two fragments here. You're going to add another enzyme. You want to find out where the site is of the other enzyme in relationship to this site, correct? What are the possible predictions? What can possibly happen when you add this second enzyme X to these two fragments? And let's assume that enzyme X only cuts one time. What is the only possibility that can happen here? It's either or. Okay, what's the answer?
So when you add another restriction enzyme, one of the original fragments will remain.
What did you just say?
Another restriction enzyme.
And what happens? What did you say?
One of the fragments will remain,
so,
and the other one will be cut
off. What's the concept of adding the second enzyme? What's the concept?
The concept is to see which one.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Doesn't matter.
No, I was just going to say, like, if
be
one
specific.
Remains, if one of the fragments remain, the other one will get cut, and so you can figure out which where that site becomes.
That's the concept. Excellent. So you have to look at the single digestions to tentatively map the single sites, but then you add the combinations to find out which of the single fragments contains the second restriction site, and that's the concept. The only way you can do that is by mapping the single sites tentatively and then putting them together, because when you put them together, it's either going to digest this fragment or that fragment, and then you can start placing where the second enzyme site is. Okay, now, not done with you guys yet. Doing a really great job, so I'm not quite done with you. So now I'm going to ask Easter a question. She's now an honorary member of your group. She's now become an honorary member of your group. Tell me how restriction enzymes work.
Oh, they cut at specific sites. And
what do you mean by a site?
On the, they cut the DNA strand into certain...
What do you mean by a site? Go ahead. Terrific.
Nucleotide sequence.
Okay. And now I'd like to have Sky join your group in an honorary way. When we say cut, what is the restriction enzyme doing? What is it doing to the DNA molecule in a chemical way, just conceptually?
In a
it's
chemical
not cutting,
way?
It's not really a scissors. I mean, we it's a metaphor, but it's not really. What is it doing?
Digesting it.
What is it digesting? What bond is it digesting?
The bond between the nucleotides.
What's the bond called?
Phosphodiester.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. Great. Okay, now, we're not going to spend time mapping these sites because you just told me conceptually how that works. But what I'd like to know from this group is how, what is the importance of these restriction enzyme sites in relationship to genetic engineering? Why would anyone want to spend, like I had at one time in my life, 2.5 years mapping the restriction enzyme sites in one gene? Why would anyone want to waste their time doing something like that?
What you're trying to do by finding the restriction enzymes of this
the sites.
Of this DNA insert is to, you want to find out where exactly the gene that you want to work with is. Assuming
okay, that would be one reason. But conceptually, what's the purpose of a restriction enzyme map? What does it allow you to do?
To figure out a DNA sequence.
What does it allow you to do?
If you know where your gene is located along the segment of DNA, you'll be able to cut around it, for instance, and use it for recombinant DNA.
And what else does a restriction map allow you to do with respect to the gene? Heather, you're now an honorary member of this group.
You can reconstruct a gene that's... been placed into like a lambda vector or something of that sort using the overlapping ends.
What's one of the most important things conceptually for a restriction enzyme map? Everything that all of you have said is true, but I want to hear the major concept of what is the purpose and significance and power of a restriction enzyme map. What do you think that is? You want to caucus this group? We'll give this group the final chance. Be precise, Mike. Okay, what's the answer?
Basically, it goes back to what a restriction is. Restriction site map is. It basically tells you where everything cuts, where all the restriction enzyme cuts for a given like set of restriction enzymes. So from that, you can do various numbers of experiments with it. For instance, if you do a partial digestion, you can do overlaps
and to show basically that you can chromosome walk and therefore sequence. You can do a cut, like I'm basically going to repeat what other people have said, that you can cut at other sites to cut around a certain gene.
But what specifically, everything you said is correct, so let's just spend one more second in saying what's the power of this map? What does it allow you to do with respect to genetic engineering?
Everything relies on this classic method. Like, you cannot do anything else until you do this. So everything, PCR, everything, you have to do this first.
So how would you be able to, let's say, clone the switch of a gene if you didn't have a restriction map, Editha? Exactly. So it provides a guidepost for everything that you'd want to do. Now, I have one final question. T, in the genomics era of sequencing, microphone, how does one obtain a restriction map?
Can you repeat the question?
In the genomics era where everything is just sequenced, how do you get a restriction map? So if you sequence the whole genome, how do you get the restriction map of the whole genome?
Could you do probes?
I want you to think about this. If you've had the sequence of the whole genome, how do you get the restriction map of the whole genome? Becca?
Well, you know that each restriction enzyme cuts or cleaves at a specific sequence, and if you have the sequence, then you can look through the sequence and identify where the restriction enzymes would cut.
So you don't need to do this anymore, do you? If you can just sequence the whole genome,
right. This
is all anachronistic.
Right.
Great. Good job. Thank you. Very good. Okay, now we're going to go to the meat, the big meat. And let's tackle, just for the sake of interest here, let's tackle question number 3. Let's talk about patents for a while. Group number 3. We've done 3. Sure, why don't we take 2 minutes? Absolutely. Go ahead. No preparing while you take this break. It's not fair. On the honor.
The nearest water company? Thank you, sir.
I'm going to give you 3 minutes. At what time?
At 5, like 3, between 5 and 5.
Yeah, we'll be done.
Professor, I'm sitting over here and I'm watching it. I'm confused then, and maybe I'm not allowed to know until after this.
Yeah, no, you're fine.
On the left and on the right, there's ladders and they don't match up. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 markers there.
So you have to draw a ruler kind of like this.
But
sometimes that happens on jobs.
Okay.
So you have to kind
of, that's what I would
have
figured
that. Extrapolate. Sometimes they don't run in exactly the same way.
So that's kind of, okay, maybe Karina just didn't specify like so, clearly enough, but that's what she was saying is that draw lines across from this 370.
Yeah,
to
but then you have to plot them. You can't eyeball it.
Right.
And when you do that, you're going to find that there's probably at least 15 alleles.
All right.
That's more scientific.
Well, it just seems like there should be something even more scientific than
no, that's
drawing
about
a ruler.
Well, that's the best way you can do it. That's the way it's done.
It's all right.
Jessica, what's going on?
Pardon?
Are you working on your project?
Which project? The movie project?
Yeah.
Now I'm working
on the project. Well, it's 2 weeks from today.
I know. I gave them strict instructions in which they haven't gotten back to me yet about helping me pick up clips. Waiting.
Mike,
the notebook I
Corey, go gather these guys up. Go find them, please. We'll never get over here.
You want?
said red, black, and blue.
Is it black and blue?
I said red, black, and blue.
I just said, get more blue.
Red, black, and blue.
Okay. Do you need more red?
I see two reds right here. They're good, too. It'll work. Good job, Justin. Keep up good work.
Don't grab these kids, will you? You got these guys. Seriously.
Okay. If everyone can have their seats. We've got group number three. We have question number three. And in 10 minutes, let's talk about patents. Go ahead.
Talk about patents first or trademarks?
No, I mean the question.
Oh, okay. Well, what is a trademark? A trademark is...
Speak up.
What is a trademark? A trademark is any symbol, name, domain name, it could be, or device, or anything that distinguishes a source of goods or source of service. And basically, it's for 10 years, and it's renewable. It has extensions of 10 years after that. And it gives the company or person, inventor, whatever, the right to exclude others from using the same label for their brand, for their goods. The significance of it, of the Clot trademark to ClotGen, is that you'd be able to identify the Clot drug to ClotGen, and nobody else can use the trademark.
Okay, good.
Very similarly, a patent is very similar to a trademark, but what it does is, a patent, it allows the inventor to have the sole right to use his invention or idea or process to himself. And it basically, he has a temporary monopoly on it for up to 20 years. And it's stated in the Constitution in Section 8, and it allows the inventor to have full control of it, and he gets to control who gets to use it, and other people can use it for commercial use if they pay the inventor royalties or through other agreement like that. And the significance of a Clot 1 patent to ClotGen would be that ClotGen would be the only company that would be allowed to use that Clot 1 gene to be able to make drugs, and no other company would be able to use a similar drug to be its competition. And also ClotGen could use the patent to be able, if they want to allow other companies to use that for other purposes, they could attain royalties by other companies. And, oh yeah, the importance of that is if ClotGen was the only company that could use the Clot 1 gene, then potential investors would be interested in that company if they knew that the Clot 1 gene had a potential to make a lot of money through drugs. And since ClotGen would be the only company to have the patent and the sole right to use it, then they would have literally no competition and be able to gain financial backing.
Okay, next.
So a trade secret is any intellectual property that is not disclosed to others or told. Essentially, it's a secret, and that's how it's protected. There's no legislation or constitution to it. So the advantages of this are there's no time limit to it. And unlike a logo, which is for 10 years, patent for 20 years, you can have a trade secret for your entire life, or for its entire lifetime or eternity, essentially. And another advantage of this is that other people can't make similar products because it's not in the public domain. There we go. Disadvantages to this are someone could reverse engineer it or independently come up with the same product, and there's no protection for you legally other than the fact that there's the the tort laws where you can't, if you like confidentiality agreements that you sign, or theft. So those are the only like legal protections that you have for it. But other than that, people would be able to come up with it by reverse engineering, and you'd have no protection, or independently, and there'd be no protection for that. Oh, and another advantage, sorry, is that it's protected in all countries.
Okay, and our invention here that we are patenting is the sequence of the Clot1 gene and the sequence of the amino acids which code for the Clot1 protein. And we are patenting all sequences that could make this same protein, as some codons are interchangeable for the same amino acids. And then we are also patenting the clot drug, as well as the process of using bacteria to make the Clot1 protein. And we claim the use of these inventions making a protein from a bacteria and making a drug which can treat hemophiliacs, which was our original intention in sequencing this gene, as well as there are potential applications in studying human biology and the biology of blood. And there are also potential applications in surgery and emergency medicine.
What are those specific applications?
For
sounds
which?
Very vague as I'm examining your patent here.
You could
What's
learn
the specific applications? You said making a drug, I'll accept that, and making the protein, which then can be used as a drug. But then you started talking about some other things, but I don't hear anything specific.
Well, you can
I hear
treat
some general thing about studying something. I'm not sure I'm going to accept that.
You can use these proteins in individuals who are afflicted with hemophilia who do not have this protein produced naturally in their own blood to save them from a life-threatening illness.
So that's using it as a drug.
Yes.
But you said to use it to study things, and I want to know what the specific applications are.
Well, as you learn more about
what are the specific applications for your patent application, not for your laboratory.
Okay.
And grant proposal.
You could use the Clot1 protein that we are producing in surgery to close wounds, or in emergency medicine when people are bleeding and you need to staunch the flow of the blood.
That's using it as a drug. It's the same thing.
Okay. Well, that falls under that specific use as a drug.
Okay. I want to know what part of your patent application you have specific uses to study, like things. You said to study things. I want to know what those specific applications are. You can withdraw that if you want, but I want to know what might those specific things be, if there are any. In other words, the question is, can you put in a patent application that you want to use something to study something when you don't have something specific that you're studying?
Okay, we're withdrawing that
Thank
from our
you.
Patent.
Next part.
All right, and the novelty of our invention is that no one has ever used bacteria to produce this Clot1 protein, and no one has previously sequenced the Clot1 gene, or no one has made a drug using this Clot1 gene to treat hemophiliacs.
Excellent.
And the non-obviousness here is in that no one else has previously used this protein for this particular use. Even though other clotting agents are available, this clot1 gene is unique and no one has ever used it before.
Is the sequence obvious too?
No, because no one else had taken the time to sequence it before.
And you couldn't just think of it, could you?
No.
Exactly. Next point. Next part.
And for the best mode of practicing, we are going to tell you how to create this protein using bacteria. And first, you will isolate the messenger RNA from the white blood cells of a healthy individual who is producing this clot1 protein. And then once you have that messenger RNA, you will use reverse transcription.
Doing a great job. We can hear from anybody else in your group.
Okay, I'll pass this question on then to our next
speaker. Doing a fabulous job, Jessica. We need to hear from some other people.
Okay, well, I'll continue then. So once you've isolated the DNA from the white blood cell, you're going to...
Why don't you talk to the class and someone will write it down with the blue pen. Go ahead.
Okay.
It's enough.
So once... what was the step you were on?
We just isolated the messenger RNA.
All right. You isolate the DNA, and from that DNA, you can...
The DNA we're isolating?
You can isolate, rather, the mRNA would be a better way, because if you isolate the DNA, it's going to have introns and exons, which aren't really necessary mm-hmm. in the production of protein. So you would want to isolate the mRNA to be able to then obtain the complementary strand using DNA polymerase to make a cDNA.
You agree with that group? Use DNA polymerase to make the complementary strand?
Oh, right, sorry. Reverse transcriptase. And then,
that's better caucus on this. You know, it's a group mark.
And then because you have one mRNA strand and one cDNA strand, you're not going to be able to use...
Just do it conceptually.
Okay, you're not going to be able to use the mRNA strand. So you're going to have to separate the two by using an alkaline solution. And then you can use the DNA polymerase to obtain the second complementary strand of DNA. Then you use S1 nuclease to delete the little hook on it.
Wonderful.
To be able to insert it into the plasmid. But before you insert it, you have to add the sticky ends, and you use terminal transferase to add the... What? That's after. Ignore that. Terminal transferase...
Speed it along, because you only have a few minutes.
You use terminal transferase to... add the sticky ends, and then you use the terminal transferase after you cut the plasmid by restricting it with the enzyme to add complementary. Then you put it in the plasmid.
Okay, so how are you going to get it to make the protein?
Make the protein? Mm-hmm. You put the plasmid into E. coli, and then the E. coli will read the plasmid and transcribe it.
Everything you said is wonderful. How do we get this protein to be made from this double-stranded cDNA of this clot1 messenger RNA?
Because the cDNA is going to code for the protein.
I know, but how do we get this cDNA to be transcribed in the bacteria?
You put the cDNA in front of a site which has a promoter that the bacteria cell will...
The eukaryotic promoter or a prokaryotic promoter?
Eukaryotic, because you want to make a human...
So you're going to have a eukaryotic promoter?
Oh, I'm sorry, prokaryote, because it's in a bacteria.
Exactly. Okay, let's go to part E. That's terrific. Let's go to the last part.
Okay, so part E, there were some objections to our patent because...
We hear from Charles here?
Yeah. Do you want him to go again?
It's okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you can start. Do you want to do the first one?
What's up to you? Okay, clot1 gene is a part of nature. Our contestant to that is that, not contention to that is clot1 gene isn't through Diamond versus Chakrabarty, right? In 1980, the Supreme Court ruled that anything made by the hands of man, touched by the hands of man, made under the sun, is no longer part of nature because it's been manipulated by man.
Right, so it's only in nature if it's in a natural state. And once you isolate the mRNA and put it into an E. coli cell, that's being engineered by the hand of man.
And
The second objection.
The second objection. No one can own human genes. Was UC Regents versus Moore, I believe, in around 1990.
Talk to the class, Charles.
The dude said that...
Are you reading something, or did you write something down? Okay, no, go ahead. So just talk. You don't need to look at anything.
It makes me comfortable when I don't have to look at people's eyes.
You need to look at anything.
Okay, so...
It ruled that if you sign over your cells or your... Now he's getting close. Okay. If you sign over... If you, for medical reasons, that you give up your...
You don't mind. This is your security blanket.
Yeah.
Huh?
Okay. I was just reading the question for clarification.
Daisy, hold it.
And it said basically that
once you give up your DNA voluntarily,
it's no longer your
property. And you have no longer any rights over it.
Okay, part three.
And the Clot 1 patent will hinder drug research and market development.
Let's hear from someone else in your group. Let's hear from Daisy.
Basically, this we object to this because when you patent something, it is published in the public domain. So. Everybody has access to it, and although it's protected under patent
laws...
Terrific
job. Thank you very, very much, all of you. Let's go to question number five, group number one. Okay, hold it down. Hold it. You guys are still in an exam here. Question number five, group number one. Yes.
I have a question regarding the last one.
Let's move on and we can ask questions at the end. Go ahead. Question number five, group number one.
I'm going to go ahead and kick things off. This question deals with something we should all be very comfortable with. We want to make a library of the DNA from this for this paralysis causing to get this paralysis causing protein gene, right? So we have all these materials. We're starting with A, right? The first thing we want to do is isolate the DNA.
Just try and be conceptual here. Okay.
We're isolating the DNA from the bacterial cells, right? We can do that by a number of means, right? Lysing the bacteria or something. We want to use a restriction enzyme to partially digest the DNA from the bacterial cells, right? We want to partially digest them so that we can get a bunch of different size fragments so that we can have a whole library going on here. And we want to specifically use ECORI because it is a restriction enzyme that will interrupt, cut in the middle of this LACZ gene, which will be important for selecting the bacterial cells that have incorporated the plasmid and the plasmids that have incorporated the foreign DNA, right? Because this is what we're hoping to do. So we digest both the DNA partially, the plasmid with ECORI. We are going to combine ligate, right, the foreign fragments, which because of the restriction enzyme we use, will interrupt the LACZ gene. And then we are prepared to transform the E. coli cells, the HB101 E. coli cells. We use some calcium chloride to make the cell membrane semi-permeable, get those plasmids in there.
Get them in.
Next I'm handing step. It off.
Okay, I'm just going to explain why we use the PUC18 plasmid and this particular strain of E. coli. We use this strain of E. coli because it's susceptible to AMP or penicillin, and it doesn't have a LACZ active site. And the plasmid that we use is PUC18. PUC18 has ampicillin resistance here and a LACZ site here. So when we insert the plasmids that hopefully contain our recombinant DNA back into the E. coli, what we do is we place it on a culture containing this chemical called... X-galactose, and what happens is if your PUC18 plasmid, when we try to ligate it with our recombinant DNA, if the DNA doesn't get taken up into the plasmid and the plasmid just rebinds to itself, when this is in the E. coli, it will turn blue with the presence of this chemical. So what we did was the ECOR1 site exists within this LACZ site. So if we inserted our DNA into here, this LACZ site would no longer be active on that plasmid, so it wouldn't turn blue. So what we're looking for is on our colonies, ones that survived, which means that they carry the plasmid, which has the resistance, and two, ones that are white and not blue, because we don't want that LACZ site to be active.
Terrific. Absolutely terrific.
Part B.
Speak into the microphone.
Okay. What you're trying to find out is...
And talk to your class.
How many clones you're going to use...
if you use the restriction enzyme Hindi 3. So first, we want to write down what we are given, which is the genome size, which is 10 megabases. And then you are given that the composition is 80% G plus C. And then you can assume that 20% is A and T. Okay, and basically, we want to get the Hindi 3 recognition site, which is AA GC TT. And what you want to get is what is the probability that this will happen in the segment or the genome?
To your class, not to me.
You want to get the probability that the site is AA GG, I'm sorry, GC TT. What you want to get is the probability that this enzyme will cut it and how many times it's going to go into the 10 megabases, and it will give you the number of clones you need. And what you're going to do is calculate the probability of the first happening times the probability of the second event, and so on.
Okay. So the way you do that... You take this. Okay, thanks. So the way you do that is you... multiply some stuff. Not to get too technical, we're kind of trying to stay conceptual here. So G and C equal 0.4, and A and T are 0.1 because you slice these in half, and you get 0.4 and 0.1. So basically, we want to see what the probability of this occurring together will be. So you get.
Great. Let's go to the next part.
Okay.
So well, what's the answer about? Okay. Do you remember? How many clones it was?
Okay, yeah. So what you do is you end up with 1.6 times 10 to the negative fifth. And if you want to find out how many times it's going to occur in 10 megabase pairs, you just multiply it by that, which would be...
What's a megabase?
Well, to the millionth. So, and you have 10 of them, so that's 1.0 times 10 to the 7th times that equals...
160.
What's that? Yeah, 160, but you got to add one for walking, so you get 161. This is so, like, I'm smart.
Not sure that it's... Why is it 161? What's the... What is the structure of the bacterial chromosome? We'll make somarin.
Well, if you're calculating the number of restriction enzyme sites, that's how many times it gets cut. So however many pieces there will be, after that is one more than that.
What's the structure of the bacterial genome? Is it linear or circular?
It's circular.
So you might have to rethink whether it's 160 or 161, depending upon whether it's linear or circular.
So it's 160.
Exactly. There is no extra piece because it's a circular genome. If you cut a circular genome with one restriction enzyme, you get one fragment. You don't get two. A circle digested once gets one, not two. How many people figured that out? Well, there's 70,000 points down the drain. Okay, let's go to the next part. You guys are doing well. Let's move along.
So we're now trying to identify the clone that contains the gene we're looking for, and we have the genome library. So we need to make a probe that's going to find it within the genome library because we want to see which colony contains the gene of interest. So on page 11, we have this chart that tells us what the amino acid sequence is. And so the mRNA is AA, GG, CC, CU. So then we need to have a probe that's DNA. So we're going to... make the probe from this, which will create TT. We just put it up there. C. C-G-G, C-G-T. So now this is the probe, and we're going to make this radioactive. And from the library, we're going to get a nitrocellulose filter and stick it onto the plate so that each colony goes onto onto the filter in the same place. So we have that it's corresponding to where they are on the plate. And we're going to stick the radioactive probe onto... Oh, no, first we need to add detergents and heat it up to denature.
And let's just do it conceptually because you're right on the right mark. We don't have to spend too much more time.
Okay.
So what's the concept here?
Okay. Well, the concept is that you...
How are you finding the clone that you want? What's the concept?
The concept is using a probe to...
And how did you make that probe?
From using the... We translated using the code from the...
Okay, now let's assume that you don't have a gene machine and you can't synthesize those nucleotides together. How are you going to find your gene? Can't do it that way because you don't have the ability to synthesize and put that sequence together. So now how do you find your gene?
We could isolate mRNA from the actual paralysis-causing bacteria.
Well, look at the question, what you have. Anton, what's another strategy? You're now an official member of this group. What's an independent strategy?
To do what? Sorry.
To identify the gene.
To use a probe from the protein.
Use a probe from the protein.
To translate
the sequence.
How's the
probe from the protein going to work? I don't know how you'd use a probe from the protein.
You can translate
the sequence. That's kind of like what the group was describing. You can't synthesize the probe because you don't have one of these gene machines. So what's an independent strategy? Group want to get together and caucus on that?
Is this a technique that doesn't involve a probe?
No, it involves a probe, but the question is what probe you're going to use.
Could we develop an antibody that would bind to the paralysis-causing protein?
Are you asking or are you telling me a different strategy?
That's the different strategy, is that you would...
So what is the strategy?
Is that you develop
Talk to your class.
Develop an antibody that will bind to the paralysis-causing protein, and then what you would need to do is make sure that when you put in the DNA that it was being expressed, so that way it would be creating the protein, and then you would have your little plate with all the antibodies sticking on it, and you would... put it down and see which ones had the protein on it.
Marvelous. Anything else from you guys? Positive? You done?
Did you want us to continue with this one? Or?
Well, I'm you know, you've identified something, but I don't know what it is. You have something that some radioactivity binds to. What's the unambiguous experiment?
Well,
someone else in the group?
Well, we now know which colony contains the...
You know which colony contains, or do you know which colony you hypothesize contains?
That we hypothesize.
So how do you contains. Nail it down 100%? Chris? Everything you said was marvelous. Now, how do you absolutely show unambiguously... that clone that you got by either of those strategies is what you think it is?
Can we caucus?
Mm-hmm. For 1 second.
How sophisticated are we allowed to be?
Sophisticated as you want to be. Okay, what's the answer?
Okay. Right, so can we isolate the DNA and sequence the nucleotides and see if the sequence matches that of the
gene?
What
do you think? You asking or are you telling? What's your strategy?
That is correct, what I just said.
Let's go to the next question. Great job. Okay, let's go to question number one, group number four. You now have 10 minutes. 10 minutes.
Test.
Go. Or less.
Good afternoon, distinguished senators, Mr. Vice President, representatives from the press. We're here from the National Academy of Sciences to lecture you about the origins of genetic engineering, the Constitution, and how the two apply to your proposed legislation.
Betty. I would like to start off by defining genetic engineering, which is manipulation of DNA material, which can be achieved through either classical breeding, which is an ancient and very natural process, or molecular genetics. And the next person will discuss the advantages and disadvantages of that, the two methods of doing that.
So there are a lot of disadvantages to classical mating breeding techniques. One is that it's very slow because it has to work across generations. Another is that you can't pinpoint specific genes that you want to isolate. You can end up with other genes that get transferred along with it. You also can't do anything across species. It has to be things that naturally breed and mate. So here's an example for you. Let's say I wanted to breed this big leaf with this leaf to make even bigger leaves. The next generation might end up with a really little leaf. There's no way of knowing. That can happen. And that's just on one generation. But if you use DNA technology to genetically engineer things,
you can be far more precise. This process, by the way, this farmer here, we had a video that put our machinery's not working, but it took 200 years to realize that their process didn't even work. Whereas genetic engineering, it's much more precise, it's a lot quicker, and you can also basically focus on the precise gene that you want to transfer. You don't have to take the bad with the good. If there's a particular trait you want to isolate, that's possible. So now for that example, you can basically take one leaf like this, do a few fancy experiments, and within a period of maybe a couple weeks, not much time at all, you can have a large, completely changed, totally different color plant. Can even glow with some green fluorescent protein if you want. It's up to you.
Fantastic.
All right, to strengthen our position, what's the call? Okay, so genetic engineering and genomic technologies can be used to uncover new bacterial genes and proteins.
Is your microphone on, T?
I don't know. Yes. Hello? Ooh. Okay. So, sorry. Genetic engineering and genomic technologies can be used to uncover new bacterial genes and proteins that might provide clues as to how bacteria cause lethal human diseases. So, a specific eye cancer example would be tuberculosis. Yes, because, with tuberculosis, before there were treatments for it, but it kind of evolved and it became resistant to those treatments. So researchers decide, hey, maybe we should check it out. So they decided to make a genomic library, and then from the genomic library, they created vaccinations, and through genetic engineering, they found better treatments for that disease.
Part E.
Okay. Well. The specific legislation.
Turn the mic on.
Hello. Okay. The specific legislation is broken up into two parts. The first part proposes to restrict federally funded recombinant DNA experiments on all human pathogenic bacteria. And the second is to ensure that results of the experiment permitted under the new statute will become government secrets and not published in scientific journals. We looked at this as two separate parts. The first part is restricting federally funded experiments. It's a government's money. According to the Elastic Clause, if they believe that anything promotes the general welfare, they are allowed to restrict it using their money. So we thought that that aspect of it was constitutional. However, the second part, would make any results government secrets, is non-constitutional. It goes against the First Amendment, which is freedom of speech, press, and inquiry. And it also goes against the Fourth Amendment, which is unreasonable search and seizure.
How does it go against unreasonable searches and seizures?
because this is your experiment and they're not allowing you to, they're making your results secrets.
So how does that deal with searches and seizures?
They're seizing your results.
I see. Is that it?
A couple more I wanted to include as well. I think Article 8.1 and the preamble promoting the general welfare, we believe that if one of these basically if it would be a threat to national security, then the government could have a right to seize it. But in this proposed legislation, you're proposing that all inventions and discoveries will become government property, and that's illegal also under Section 8.8, basically the right for inventors to have ownership over their inventions, once again, if it was a threat to the government.
What's the invention here? I didn't say anything about any invention in here. There's nothing said in here about patents or inventions or anything. It talks about research, but doesn't talk about inventions.
Yeah, what about possible inventions that would come about from this research? So this is more a hypothetical future.
Leo Szilard published a patent on a chain reaction in England in 1938, and it was never made public until after the war, and he had a patent on it, and the chain reaction allowed the development of the atomic bomb, and he held the patent, and it was never made public until after the war was over. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're seizing it if you did that, if it wasn't made public.
Right, well, this legislation...
You turn your microphone on.
It is on. This legislation seems to be too restrictive, and the government does have the right to say this does not promote the general welfare in terms of maybe bioweapons and nuclear bombs and stuff like that. But this is restricting all types of recombinant DNA experiments, and that does not promote the general welfare because we don't get the kind of technology that, you know, T already talked about if we restrict that, and they are allowed to restrict some things if it is threatening to the country, but in general, this is way too restrictive and would be deemed unconstitutional.
So it's a bit murky, though, isn't it?
Yes.
I wrote it that way on purpose.
We know. We could tell.
Good job. Thank you. Good job. Okay, let's go to question number 4. And that's going to be group number... 5. And I know all of you have been sitting very patiently, and I know that it's tired to listen to everyone, but we're getting down to the witching hour, and give them the same attention they gave you, and also be prepared for a couple of surprises. Anton.
Okay, so in...
Anton. He was an honorary member of the last group or the group before. He just took it down a few points, didn't he? You marked it, didn't you? Let me see. Okay, good. Go ahead.
Okay, so in this question, we are...
Gotta be brief now.
Only we are coding for the paralysis-causing protein, and we have found the amino acid sequence of the protein, and it's given to you in question 4. Interesting...
Now, I want to time out here. What I want you to do is answer this question conceptually. Okay.
So we have an amino acid
you can
sequence.
Read the code.
Interestingly, we have a 2-nucleotide genetic code, as you have in your papers. And using that code, we find the corresponding nucleotide sequence conceptually. We don't have to do it out because you guys are all very smart and able to do that.
No editorializing.
The 5' end would correspond to the N. End of the amino acid sequence, and the 3' would correspond to the C end of the amino acid sequence.
So let's have the next person in the group now.
Okay, so when after you get the sequence of the mRNA, the next question is asking what is the entire paralysis-causing protein gene? And the way the mRNA is created is it actually is complementary to the nonsense strand. So then the sequence that you get coding for the gene is actually almost the same as the mRNA strand, except you replace the U's with the T's. Should I continue?
No, go to the next one.
Just a note, to make the complete gene, you would have to put out both strands. And then so to find the non-transcribed...
We hear from someone else in the group.
You also have to include the stop codon to include the entire gene for the amino acid.
Good. And what is that stop codon?
That stop codon is UU on the mRNA, and that would be TT on the
next
strand.
Part. Part D.
Okay. With a little research, we determined that the length of each nucleotide base is 0.3 nanometers, 0.34 nanometers.
Who determined that, and how was that determined?
When
was that determined, and by whom?
I couldn't get a. I
think you can.
Well, we discovered it, and then confirmed it.
No, I think I'd really like to know who determined that, and when.
Watson and Crick.
Are you sure about that?
Fairly.
Positive. All you guys want to get together? You all wrote an essay on the double helix. Let's make Jordan an honorary member of this group. Where was that measurement derived from?
I believe crystallography was used, and from that, there's a lot of physics that go along with it, but you can determine
so who determined
how
that measurement?
Rosalind Franklin.
Thank you.
Determined that.
Exactly.
So with the help of Rosalind Franklin's measurements, we determined that it's 3.4 to the 10 to the negative 10 meters is one nucleotide. And the sequence we have is 10 bases. So we multiply that by 10, and it gives you 3.4 times 10.
Great.
To negative 9.
Next part. So what are the anticodons?
The anticodons are the complementary nucleotides to the mRNA.
And where are they located? On what molecule?
I'm sorry, what?
What molecule are they located on? The anticodons.
Ribosome? Where?
The tRNA.
The tRNA?
Are you guys sure about that? So we'll make Hannah an honorary member of this group. Where? What molecule are the anticodons located on?
They're on the complement of the tRNA.
Are they on the tRNA, or where are they? Are they on the ribosomes? Where are the anticodons located? Karina, you want to be an honorary member of this group?
The anticodons are on the tRNA, which also has the amino acid attached to it.
So, okay. Let's go to the next part, F.
Okay. Our group determined that there were two possibilities for the mutation forming the way it did. I'll write this up on the board.
Why don't you conceptualize for us?
Okay. All right. So the DNA gene sequence for this particular...
Go ahead.
...would be... Let me take a look at the chart here.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you just conceptualize how the mutation might have occurred?
Okay. The first possibility here is that in the mutation, the amino acid glycine is not present at the end. That could either be because, one, the glycine, which codes for glycine, which I think is CT. CT on DNA.
Why don't you step back a second? And just tell me, what are the possible ways in which you can get mutations?
Okay.
Talk to the class.
There could be a deletion in which CT was completely absent from the sequence.
So the first way it could happen is just delete the final codon, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
Or there could be a single nucleotide polymorphism, in which perhaps the C was replaced by T. Therefore, the CT would become TT, which is the stop codon, and therefore it prematurely stop the sequence. So then,
great.
Glycine would be not present.
Do you know one other way, maybe, or you're doing terrific?
There could be an insertion,
mm-hmm.
which, as a result, made change first. So for glycine, one of the two bases is different, so glycine is not present, and it's that wouldn't code for an amino acid.
Terrific. Okay, what about the significance of genetic diversity? One more minute, and that's it.
Okay, specifically in, well, genetic diversity in general, but specifically in bacterial populations, bacteria reproduce asexually with, there's some measure of transference as well, so, but more or less the alleles are, without mutation, the alleles would be limited to those already within the population, and mutations spontaneously can create new alleles, which increases the number of alleles, which would increase genetic diversity.
And what's the significance of that to the bacterial population?
It allows them to adapt to different environments. Like, for instance, in bacteria, you would want to have resistance to antibacterial chemicals and stuff, and it would help them survive better.
Good. Now let's just have a mechanism of how this all works and wrap it up in 30 seconds.
The linear mechanism is that DNA turns codes for RNA, and then RNA would in turn codes for the amino acids, which in turn code for proteins, and or compose proteins, and therefore a change in the DNA sequence, a mutation in the DNA sequence, would result in a different protein. And because proteins' structure affects their function based on their shape or binding sites, or in this particular case, the absence of an entire amino acid, it could not perform the same function, in this case, killing people and mice.
Does anyone have any questions for this group? Kyle? You have a question for Kyle? Good job. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to group number 6 and question number 2. I'd like you all to give them your undue attention. And this question deals with inheritance of a specific disease.
Is this my...
And... As soon as I get this thing off. Okay, there we go.
Yeah, I'll try to be really quick.
You have 8 minutes to answer it, max.
So first off,
very specific.
First off, we determined that this was actually a dominant gene. There's many ways you can establish this, which kind of leads into part B.
How did you establish that it was a dominant gene?
Well, let me...
conceptually.
Okay. So the only way that two parents who display the trait could produce offspring who did not display the trait would mean that they would have to be heterozygous. Excellent. And in order for them to be heterozygous and display the trait, it would have to be dominant.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Next part.
All right, so the basic concept here is we want to change the lambda viral vector to carry the DNA from the clot gene and get it into, so once it's in the virus, then we can get it into the bacteria cells, so we can grow a colony of bacteria, some of which contain the desired gene. And then using blotting techniques and then probing techniques, we can decide which, find out which ones of the bacteria actually contain the gene and... or the clones that contain gene. So that's basically a library. You derive that from the bacteria.
Okay. And what vector are you going to use here?
We're using the lambda viral vector.
And what's the advantage of using the lambda viral
vector? Well, it can fit in. Well, when I did it specifically, when we did it specifically, using EcoR1, you can get a fragment that will fit into the lambda viral vector because it contained, I think, 20. It can hold 20 kbs. So that's good because you can.
Are you going to do a complete digestion of the DNA or a partial
digestion? A partial digestion.
Okay, good. Okay.
Next, you would use chromosome walking because you only have.
Well, first of all, I haven't heard how I find which is my clone from the library. How do you find the clone?
Well, you're going to end up running a. Because the probes.
Tell me, where do you get this probe from?
You make a probe from the sequence that you have of the CLOT1 gene.
How does that work conceptually, Sam?
How does what work conceptually?
How do you have the sequence of the protein and make the probe?
Well, yeah, we've been given we have this N met sequence, and mm-hmm. we can go backwards from that to find the DNA.
Backwards conceptually, how?
Protein, amino acid, RNA.
How does that
DNA.
Work conceptually?
Reverse.
What are you going to use to do that?
Our knowledge of the relationship between coding, right?
What's the word here?
Coding, right?
Like, what's the word? Not code. What's the word you're going
to use? Collinerary.
Yeah, what are you going to use in order to make that translation? One of the most famous discoveries of the 20th century in molecular biology demonstrated unambiguously throughout the last 8 weeks of this class by genetic engineering experiments. What's going to allow you to do that?
The genetic code, the human genetic code.
You just said it. Okay, move to the next part.
Okay. Like I started before, you already have the single genetic clone in part C, but you only have the 5' end. So you have to find the unambiguously identify the genome clone. So you use a process called chromosome walking, and you synthesize a probe based on the 5' end, and that probe will bind to the complementary sequence and plus a little bit more. So you use that the end of the second part, synthesize a new probe. You keep doing that until you hit the stop codon. And after you hit the stop codon, you've cloned the whole gene.
Happens if the gene has 563 introns in it, and all of those introns have stop codons? How do you know where the end of the gene is? Remember, we talked about the factor 8 gene, which is 100 and some thousand nucleotides in length, of which the average exon was about 80 nucleotides. And so by chance and chance alone, if there's these introns, you're going to get tons of stop codons. So how are you going to know where the beginning and the end of the gene is?
You use the RNA, which doesn't have those introns next.
Pardon?
You use mRNA, which doesn't have those extra things.
So now you're going to try and use the gene to find the mRNA, to make the cDNA, to sequence the cDNA, to align it with the gene, figure out what the structure of the gene is. Is that what you're proposing?
Yes.
James?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And after that, you can use the restriction map, restriction site map, to create the whole gene again.
Mm-hmm. Still not clear how you find the beginning and the end of the gene.
The 5' end?
Mm-hmm. 3' end and all of that. Still not clear. It's clear to you, Kyle?
That's the function of the chromosome walking, right? The probe.
How do you know when to stop walking, though?
You find the stop.
The end of the chromosome.
No, you find the stop. You know, you find the stop sequence.
But there may be stop sequences in the intron. So how do you know where to stop? You're walking.
Get rid of the
walking
introns.
Down the chromosome Throw them now. Out of there. Hundreds of millions of bases. When do you stop? Guys want to talk to each other, or are you just going to sort of stand there? Patricia, you're now an honorary member of this group.
We know the total length.
The total length is...
What's the answer? What's the answer?
We
When you were rescreening, you had...
How do you know what the when you come to the end of the gene?
You have no more probes binding to the...
How do you know? Well, you can get to the end of the chromosome if you keep walking.
End of the chromosome?
What do you think, group?
It says it's 20,000 amino acids long.
Okay. But since you don't know how many introns or exons in the gene there are, knowing the size of that protein doesn't help you very much.
Well, can't we use the mRNA to figure out the end of the mRNA, and the end of the mRNA is going to be the same with the end of the gene?
How are you going to find the messenger RNA?
What?
I spent a whole lecture on this a week and a half ago or whatever. Actually, how are you going to find the messenger RNA?
Can I have Gavino be part of our group?
Brian Wong, you're now an honorary member of this group.
I'm really not sure. I just thought we'd look for this first
stop. So if you walk, you walk to the end of the chromosome. That's not going to tell you where the end of the gene is. And if you look for stop codons, it's not going to help you because there could be a million stop codons and introns on the basis of chance and chance alone. So you're starting, and now you don't know where to end. So what do you think, Daisy? You have this probe, which represents the 5' end of the gene, so you theoretically could look for what? Find where the gene is? I think I spent at least 2 hours on it.
Wait, you have the 5' end, so like...
So what could you
the
look complement for?
The complement of that is going to be the 3' end.
So what could you... No, the complement of that is not the 3' end. What could you look for that would tell you unambiguously where the beginning and the end of the gene is that could be used as a tool? You don't have the sequence of the protein, you just have the sequence of one end. What could you use? I remember very specifically I gave you a Scientific American article as a handout. And I remember that I talked for approximately from 3:30 to 6 o'clock. And then I sent you an email after that. And someone in the class asked, when are we going to find out how we know what the gene is, that the protein is that codes for the gene? Anyone want to stab at it? Ben. It's not easy, I know.
Could you use it? A marker on the chromosome?
How do you find out where this gene is active, Charles? Lisa, go ahead.
Do you want to pass up your mic?
No, another mic, not their
There's
mic.
There's two right there.
Two right there. Thank you.
How do you find out where this gene is active? You have...
If it's active, then it will be replicating?
No. Always replicates, doesn't have to be active. The genome replicates, and most of the genome's not. Summer.
At the end of the gene, you're going to be seeing large strands of mRNA coming
off of it.
How
do you find out where the gene is active and what cell? Chris. Not going to let you off the hook here. You can look for the presence of the protein, but that's going to be awfully hard from using a DNA probe. So how are you going to find where this gene is active? Betty? I can't hear you. You're so quiet.
You look at the switches?
No. Heather?
Wouldn't you be able to check in a specific cell? Like if you're looking for the insulin gene, you could check a pancreas cell and see
how
where it's active.
How? Radina. Everything you said was correct, by the way.
Since this is a clotting factor...
How are you going to find the beginning and the end of the gene? Let's be very specific about that. We have a knowledge of the beginning of the protein. The group made an excellent library. They used the beginning of the protein amino acid sequence in the genetic code to synthesize a probe. They found a clone which represented the beginning of that gene. Everything is correct. They used chromosome walking, which was great. They started walking down that chromosome, and how do they know where to stop and get the end of the gene? They don't have any other information. Want to take it again?
Maybe since it's something that's expressed in the blood, you check the chromosomes of the blood and take a picture of it, and no?
I know you can do better than that. Let's one more crack. Karina? Go on.
You can take the protein and try to sequence the amino acids and figure out every possibility, and then use that as a probe to find the end and then figure
out. Or how about sequencing the protein and finding the amino acids and translating that back and starting to look for nucleotide sequences that you sequence in your clones and again reverse translating and match the nucleotide sequence with the presumptive sequence that you get from the protein. Or an easier way to do that is exactly like on the Scientific American article that I know all of you read, because I gave it to you, subject of my lecture, which would be that when they got the factor VIII gene, they didn't know where they were, so they did walking in each direction. But in order to guide them to where the gene was, they went back and determined that the gene was active in the liver. They then cloned the cDNA for the factor VIII, which doesn't have any introns or anything, sequenced the factor VIII cDNA, and then compared the cDNA sequence to the gene sequence. The cDNA sequence has the end of the gene and the beginning of the gene, and now you know. So the easiest way is to go back and get the cDNA clone from where the gene is active. Okay, let's wrap this up. What's the next part?
Okay, to find the minimal number of clones, it says in the prompt that there are 20,000 amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
And here it says that there are 20,000 bases or 20 kilobases. And we know that there are 3 nucleotides per amino acid. And so you multiply the amino acids times 3 and then divide it by 20,000.
Trying to understand how you get the number of clones that you'll have that.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Should I write the numbers up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 20,000 amino acids times 3 nucleotides per amino acid over 20,000 base pairs.
Good. So how many clones?
3 clones.
Great. Let's finish this up. Now, how do you obtain probes representing RFLP marker diagnostic for the mutant and normal genes? Go ahead.
First, you take blood samples from, or you extract DNA from both the healthy and sick members of the family.
Good.
And then you digest it completely with the restriction enzyme.
Good.
And then you use gel electrophoresis on the different, you know, samples of DNA, and you know, you do your all the steps that entails.
Do your blotting.
Yeah, the blotting, and you use the probes, which are that will hook up with the CLOT1 gene, and then
you use one probe or all the probes for the gene. What are you going to use, Jason? You're now an honorary member of this group. How are you going to find these RFLPs?
If you assume that the mutation causes a restriction site to be deleted, that means that the mutant allele will be longer than the normal allele.
I don't know if it would be longer. It could be shorter. But how are you going to find it again? Go ahead, James.
Oh, You do your blot, and then you look at the...
You can use one restriction enzyme or many restriction enzymes?
Oh, one.
Just one. How do you know that one gives you the polymorphism?
It might not.
So what are you going to do?
Well, after you look at the audio radiograph, if there's like a clear indicator and correlation.
And if there isn't, what are you going to do?
You go back to and use a different restriction enzyme until you get the
And how many different
correct...
probes are you going to use?
You use the correct.
Let's say you've walked along the chromosome and you have 17 clones. What are you going to use as your probes? Do you know where the mutation is in the gene?
You use multiple probes, yeah.
But now your strategy, as I understand it, is to get DNA from the diseased individuals and DNA from the healthy individuals in this family. You're going to isolate the DNA, and you're going to use a DNA blot, and you're going to use probes across the gene, and you can use different enzymes in order to find your RFLP.
Yeah.
What's a much easier way to do that in this day and age?
Genome sequencing probably helps.
Genome sequencing, or be specific. What's a much easier way to do that? Chris?
Do you make the probe?
I need your microphone. Doesn't involve any probes. Matt Emmer. We're living in the genomics era now.
Can we sequence the...
Or are you giving me another strategy here?
Okay, well, in today's day and age, you could sequence the gene that produces this protein. And based on that, you can look at basically the restriction sites that exist.
Restriction sites or... So you're sequencing which gene? The normal gene and the... Tell me specifically.
Okay, so we can sequence the two and then look at differences between the two of them.
And if you look at the differences, what do you automatically have then?
A way to indicate
which one's which. Exactly. So you don't have to do this anymore.
We just thought we'd show you the complicated
way. I know, exactly. Now, let's wrap this up with one final thing.
Okay. So when you look at the pedigree, it shows pretty clearly that individual 3 does have the disease and individual 8 does not. And if you further look at the pedigree, you will determine that individual 3 is heterozygous for the trait, meaning he has one dominant and one recessive allele. And since the mutation occurs on only one of these alleles and it causes a deletion in a restriction site, that means there's going to be one large fragment instead of two small fragments that result from one of the alleles. So you're going to end up with a total of 3 pieces, whereas with individual number 8, you have 2 alleles both displaying the recessive trait. And so that's why they appear thicker, but in fact this is 4 fragments at 2 different locations because they're 2 different lengths.
Does anyone have any questions for this group about anything that's been covered in the entire class?
I dare you. Let's see. What you got? Come on.
Josh.
I have a question about the patent.
About this question.
He said the entire class.
He was joking. Jerk. Put the microphone down.
Ask him about the patent.
Okay,
hold it. We're not done yet.
In the patent, the patent writers claim to be asking for a patent on
creating.
Well, is the process of creating a protein from a cDNA sequence patentable?
Yes.
And has it not already been patented? Because it's been done before, correct?
Just doing it from E. coli. It's the process of doing it specifically with this protein.
So that process is patentable, even though the actual process is obvious, based on the fact that...
Because it requires specific, you need to know the specific DNA sequence. You need to know what types of probes you need. There's just all types of little parts to it that are unique to this protein.
Any other questions before we have some fun final business that we have to do before we let you go? Good job. Thank you. Can I have the grades, please? So while we were doing this, can I have yours, Gloria?
Sure.
Thank you. Good. Do you want to use the calculator? Or? Huh?
Yeah, let's look one up.
Nico, did you learn anything in this exercise? Did you? Where's your microphone? Did you learn anything?
I don't know if I should say this.
Say whatever
you
want.
Incriminating.
I'm immune.
In all honesty, I didn't get a lot in the midterm, so I learned a lot when we like did it just now.
Oh, okay. That's too bad. Does everyone feel the same way? I'd be awfully depressed. Make go home and take some Prozac or something. God. How many people felt that they learned something with this exercise? Great. How did you like this oral exam format? You liked it? So you thought you're going to have to come here and answer all these questions on your own, right? You like that, huh? I'd never do that to you. Nick almost had a heart attack when I answered that question in class the other day. Okay, I think you all did really a spectacular job. I mean, considering that the science that you're learning is relatively sophisticated, and you couple all of that with the non-science that you're learning, and you couple all of that with the precision to which I'm trying to get you to learn this, I think that you really, really, really did a fabulous job. And so therefore, for this exam, everyone gets a score of 100%. And so you all go away, and you get 50,000 points for this oral exam. Now, you might not all be so lucky when you have your final oral exam, because it's going to be graded in a slightly different way, which we'll talk about next week. I can't guarantee you all get 100% on your take-home test. It's going to be interesting to see how the results, but I can guarantee you that Gloria and I and Mike and a couple others will be grading these questions very seriously and taking your answers into account over the weekend. And so while you're off doing other things because you have no quiz for this week and catching up on other classes and stuff and relaxing from all the hard work that you did and savoring your 50,000 points, please rest up because next week we'll start again on Tuesday. And congratulations for a great job. And thank you very, very, very much just from me personally on behalf of Gloria and Mike for taking this very seriously and putting forth all of the effort that you did in order to learn and try and perform as well as you can. And from my point of view, it just really touches my heart seriously in how well you guys did today. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Tuesday.